dropping me, and the great food, and the lovely bingo lady, so many fun facts. It was just like the best. And, you know, I have 30 minutes, so I'm just going to, like, get into it and tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today for me. Anyway,
I thought he was handing me my phone.
Okay, just to get the stats out of the way, I surrendered to this program March 1st, 2005. I'm 20 years today. Please keep it on the down low because I've been trying to call my sponsor all morning, and I don't want her to hear about it. she was the person that I wanted to, you know, thank her first. If it wasn't for her and her loud voice and her speaking my language, she speaks Darlene very well, I would not be standing here. I'd probably be in jail or, you know, psych ward or, I don't know, dead maybe. My home group is West LA Stepped Up. My sponsor is Vinoy Shah. And I am here with you guys, just so grateful for this program and what it's given me. And I'll tell you just a little bit of background. I come from an alcoholic home. I have a long line of alcoholism on my dad's side and mental illness on my mom's side. And they were both immigrants, and I think that makes me more special than you, because here's why. And one of my really dear friends are first generation, and I've convinced them also that we're all special. And here's why. It's because we grew up in the old culture, and, you know, coming here to America, you know, it's like my American friends, I was born here, by the way, my American friends did not understand why my parents did things a certain way. And I used to think, you know, my dad was the alcoholic, and I knew from a very early young age that we were different. And as it turns out, the older I got and the more I realized what was happening in my family, my dad was no different than anybody else's dad. Mm-hmm. But my dad blacked out. Like, you know, my uncles and cousins and everybody, they would pass out when they got home. My dad would pass out at the party. And, you know, my dad was a good guy. You know, he was quiet. He was very quiet. He just tried to stay out of the way. It was my mom who was the crazy person. She had a lot of rage in her, you know, and she took that rage out on me mostly. And how we grew up, you know, my dad, it got to a point where my dad could not stop drinking, okay? He was drinking around the clock. At that time, I'm from San Pedro, and we were living in an apartment building, and my dad had two brothers, my grandmother and one brother was in one apartment, we were in another apartment, and another brother and his family were in a different apartment. And my grandmother, she made wine down in the cellar. And my dad would go down there and suck on that hose and try to get that wine down. And then he'd come back upstairs and he'd smoke a cigarette and he'd throw the cigarette somewhere. And I would, you know, I was this little kid. I was super sensitive. And It was my job to make sure that my dad did not burn the apartment building down. It was my job to make sure that my dad had made it to bed. And, you know, from a very, very young age, my mom made it my responsibility. She says, you know, if you tell your dad not to drink, he won't. And I took that to the gates of insanity. I took that not just with my dad, but with everybody in my life. You know, fast forward, as I got older, you know, I knew I was always a little bit off. You know, I'm off like now. I feel like, you know, I'm not everybody's flavor. I'm really not. And if you like me, you like me. And Al-Anon has given me the gift of just, I just like who I am. I do, finally. Because when I came here, I had such low self-worth. I hated myself. And, you know, that it was, you know, and I felt different. You know, my mom, she had no business having children. I don't have a regular story. It's just whatever comes as I'm talking. It's just, you know, whatever God wants me to talk about. I really don't have a doubt. So, just to let you guys know that. So I don't know where I'm going right now. Just stay with me, okay? Anyway, so I don't remember my mom not beating me up or saying something to me, because what happened was she was trying to manage and control my dad's drinking, and she couldn't. And she was super hyper aware of what all the neighbors were thinking and what everybody else was thinking. And she didn't know what to do with that anger. She didn't know what to do with all that anxiety. And so she would take it out on me. And, you know, I remember a few times, like when she would come at me, I could tell, you know, her eyes were blank. Like the rage was, like I knew, well, I'll tell you this, my brother years later, because I never, you know, my brother, you know, it kind of rolls downhill. You know, my mom hit me and then I hit my brother, but he never told on me. And I asked him, you know, years and years ago, I said, how come you never told on me? And he said, because I was afraid she's going to kill you, for real. So that's how I came to Al-Anon. You know, there was a lot of things that, you know, I had to unravel. And so fast forward, you know, I'm an adult and I really don't know how to be in relationships. And I could not ever make the connection that it's possible that what I learned growing up was spilling over into my adult life. I had no idea. I couldn't see it. And really and truly, the last place I wanted to go was Al-Anon. And I'll tell you how much I resisted. I was introduced to Al-Anon in 1991. I did not surrender. But when I did, I did. Until 05, okay? So don't do that. It's purgatory, really and truly. Like when I look back on it now, it's just like, it was like living in purgatory. It's like the answer was sitting right next to me. And I kept going to the back row for the answers. You know, AA, the big book talks about singleness of purpose. And so I tried, and I'm all for everything that I'm about to list here, but like I threw therapy at my Al-Anon stuff. I threw communications class at my Al-Anon stuff. I threw like going to psychics at my Al-Anon stuff. I did Reiki, whatever, over my Al-Anon stuff. I threw so many things at my Al-Anon, anything but come to Al-Anon. I got married, and When I got married to a sober alcoholic, and when I got married, you know, we were friends for a while, for like 8 years, and we got married. I mean, how perfect. You know, we know each other, there's no getting to know each other. You know, when we got married in the Catholic Church, we did that psychology thing, we passed with flying colors. I mean, we were the couple to be. Not as soon as we came home from the honeymoon, the only thing I could think of is, what the hell did I just do here? Okay? And I was miserable. Nobody told me, you know, everybody talked about, oh, the honeymoon lasts a year, or, you know, it was like 5 minutes. But what happened was I didn't have any tools to be married, is what it was, okay? And all of a sudden I'm married, and all the reasons why I love my husband so much and why I married him was gone. I couldn't see the good. And so we got married in 95, and I'm going to meetings, but I'm not doing anything because I think I know better, because I have the answers, and I'm going to figure this out, because my mom told me that if I told my dad to stop drinking, and I would, he would. And, you know I just need to figure this out, and then it'll all be okay, you know, and it got worse and worse and worse. Finally, it got so bad I wanted to blow up my life. And that was like in 04. If you looked at my life from the outside, everything looked good. I had a husband who loved me. We lived in a nice home. I had friends. We had a big group of friends that we were hanging out with. But I was miserable. I could not be happy. I didn't know that it was the stuff that I never dealt with growing up in alcoholism. You know, I can tell you the two times that my mom was nice to me growing up, I brought all that into my relationship. And so in 2004, you know, I decided that I was going to divorce my husband, and I needed to tell my mom. And I noticed how I'm not talking about my dad, because my dad was just a quiet alcoholic. He had his chair, he'd take the newspaper and put it in front of his face, and you never saw him. It was like he disappeared. My little brother, growing up in this madness, this chaos, this like, what we grew up with, I don't remember him being there. And I just remember me being there with my crazy mother. And my dad was really good at disappearing. So, because all the focus was on my mom's rage. So I get married and I decide that this marriage isn't gonna work. And he's the same person that I married. What it felt like is, he felt like I wasn't on his team, and I felt like he was attacking me. None of that was true. That was true growing up in alcoholism, but that wasn't happening in my family, with my husband, and I could not see it. So I decided to blow up my life, and I thought, I'm just gonna divorce him. I'll tell my mom, because she's gonna be the one that's gonna be the most dramatic about it. And I'm just gonna go and do something else. I'm leaving. And my sponsor at the time said to me that, well, the Vinoy at the time, she talked to me because I was kind of like, you know, I was talking to people in LA. I wasn't going, but I was just talking to people about it. And they all suggested, you guys suggested that I, you know, go to...
Yeah, 20.
20 more minutes? Suggested that maybe what I should do is start going to Al-Anon and go for real and not do what I'm doing. Okay. So I thought about it. I'm like, I don't know. That's a little rash. I don't know if I can do that. I'd much rather blow up my life. So anyway, a friend of mine, we were at the Monday night Westchester meeting, and a friend of mine, Norma, and she doesn't remember this, but I don't know, in that moment, you know, when God just opens up the door just a little bit and the light shining through just a little bit, Norma walked up to me because she saw what I was doing in Al-Anon, and she said, you know, she says, this is life or death, darling. I don't know what you're doing playing around with this. She said, you need to go over and ask Vinoy to be your sponsor. And I never even liked Vinoy. I mean, I was one of those people where she would go up to the podium and start talking, and I would find it necessary to get up and go to the bathroom while she was talking. Like, I couldn't stand her accent. It's like, Jesus, jihad. And Norma said to me, you need to go over and ask Vinoy to sponsor you, and I don't know what made me do it, but I did it. I walked over to her, and she looked me up and down, and she's like, huh. She saw me for years going in and out, in and out, in and out. Oh my God, I remember there's this girl, June, in our group, and she tried to sponsor me for half a minute. I cornered her in the parking lot and like literally started like interrogating her. Like, what about your life? What about your marriage? Like, I'm doing this to poor June, and she's backing out away from me. And I, you know, it's like that anger that I had didn't go away. You know, I just brought it along with me. You know, the anger that my mom had, I ended up inheriting, and I brought it into all my relationships. Anyway, I finally asked Vinoy. She said, okay, what do you want from me? And I said, really and truly, and this just blurted out of my mouth. I still, like, it's just interesting to me how God works in my life. You know, I said to her, I want to forgive my mom while she's alive. I don't want to have to write that letter on her grave. And Vinoy said, okay, let's do it. So, wouldn't you know, my God, I cried. Ugh, I can't tell you guys. Fetal position for a year, my first year. Number one, that I had to be an Al-Anon. Okay, that alone, like just... I'm going to kill myself. What in the hell? And then the other part is when I surrendered, there was something inside of me that was sort of relieved. Like, okay, I don't have to do this anymore by myself. I could do it with all of you guys. And I just need to follow direction. And I don't know if you guys know Vinoy, anybody here, but she's kind of scary. And my mom was scary. So I didn't really listen to you if you were like June. I needed somebody that was going to stand up to my anger, my fear, my Al-Anonisms. I needed somebody that was going to get in the ring and tell me to shut up. You know, and I needed to be a little bit afraid. Not everybody's like that. You know, some people, you know, have friends that, you know, grew up a lot like how I did, and they can't handle that. They can't handle that sort of direction, but I can't, here, I'll look for loopholes. If I see something like, you know, if I see that you're kind of weak, I'll go in and start doing it my way, you know? And so so we started my journey, and we started our journey. And the first thing that she told me, I swore that I would never forgive my mother for what she did. You know, and if I told you the list of things that she did, you guys would hate her too. But the problem with that is I can't live with that. I can't live with it. And I don't even know how much it's affecting me. And so the first direction she gave me was, you are not to scream at your mother. Do you hear me? And it was like, yes. And this is how desperate I was at that time to get better, because I really was afraid that something was going to happen. I was going to things aren't going to go well if they talk about resentments. I cannot afford to have those kind of resentments. I've seen Al-Anon women who have come to Al-Anon and left. And they are bat as crazy. They're crazier than they were when they first came. Just because you leave doesn't mean, oh, you're fine. No, it's just like alcoholism. It's like all your isms come back and you're a crazy person. And you know, for me, it was like, as my friend Sarah used to say, there's the great examples and the loud warnings. And I started paying attention to the loud warnings. I didn't want to be like a, you know, I didn't want to go in that direction. Anyway, so, you know, she told me to do that. So one of the promises that I made to her and myself is every time I'd slip, I would call her, okay? Like, for example, the first year in Al-Anon, she told me not to talk to my brother because I could not, I was in so much fear over my brother's alcoholism and over his family's alcoholism, that my way of telling him how concerned I was telling him that his oldest daughter was gonna end up on a pole, and the youngest daughter was gonna end up giving, you know, I'm not gonna say it from the podium, you know, I would say such inappropriate things to him, thinking that was the right thing to do. You know, everything that came from in me, you know, if I loved you, it was just like, I'm beating you over the head with my love, okay? And saying, it took a long time for my brother and I for all of that to unravel and for him to trust me. And I can tell you today, we have the best relationship. It's the relationship I've always wanted. I just love and adore that guy. Anyway, so Benoit said to me, I don't care if your mother hits you over the head with a frying pan, you are not to yell at your mother. Do you hear me? And I went, okay. And that I heard, frying pan. Yes, okay. I'm gonna be all right. And that began the journey when I stopped screaming at her. That began the journey of my healing towards my mother, okay? So now, fast, really fast forward. I did not know this was gonna be about my mom, but here. fast forward, so it took so much work, okay, not to be mad at her. And I had to forgive her. And I did not realize how much that was tying me down. how much it was keeping me away from relationships. In the meantime, by the way, my relationship with my husband got so good. I mean, he was freaked out when he heard that I joined Al-Anon. He goes, oh my God, he goes, they're gonna, you know, what are they gonna say? You know, he was all worried about what people were gonna say because I was in Al-Anon. And I was going to one meeting a week, and then I started going to two, and he goes, oh, Jesus, dar, they're going to think I'm beating you. It's like, stop. but, you know, but he said to me, like, I was on my way, I was turning three in Al-Anon, and I decided I was going to quit, that it didn't work, and he was listening to me. I was on my way to the meeting, and he's listening, and he... And I said, I'm taking my cake. I don't even know what I'm going to say. He goes, I'm going to tell you what to say to those people. And I said, I was really quiet. He goes, you tell those people that since you've been coming to Al-Anon, you've become a much nicer person, especially towards me. I had Vinoy crying on the floor. I guess, okay, I had the whole first row. I mean, I was like so floored by that Al-Anon had changed me. I didn't even see it. That, you know, he was just like, you're not going anywhere. This is where you're going to stay. So anyway, my mom and I, she got sick. She started to get dementia. I get a call like at 4:30 in the morning that she's doing something, and the paramedics were on their way and the fire trucks were on their way. And, oh, actually, by that time, I kind of knew who they were. San Pedro is not that big of a town, so paramedics knew to call everybody. And they said, you know, if your mom doesn't open the door, we're going to have to bash it in. So I got in the car, and I jammed down there, and I called Vinoy, and she didn't pick up. It was like 5 a.m. or 4:30 a.m., whatever. I called my friend Karen, who's in Arizona. She's my Al-Anon sister, and Karen didn't pick up. And, you know, Sandy Beach talks about having, you know, asking God to go in before me. And so I did that. I prayed, and I walked in, and I saw her, and she was, like, so scared. She was not where she was at. She was somewhere when she was a little girl. And my sponsor talks about, you know, some of us come here on this earth, we don't get the blessing. We're put on this earth to give the blessing. And in that moment, something came over me, and I just grabbed her, and I gave her what she never gave me. And, you know, she was like, something was going to get her, and I said, and I'm going to beat him up. Nobody's going to come get you. They have to get through me. And she's looking at me, and she looked like a little kid, and it was the first time I saw like the sparkle in her eyes. It was the very first time. And I was like, I said, I'm going to beat them up. And she started laughing and giggling, and she was all happy. And, you know, we were there for like an hour, and she kind of calmed down, and she kind of came back to, and I realized in that moment that I was put on this earth to give her the blessing. And I will tell you, that feeling, what that did is it changed my life. It changed my life. There was no reason for me, all that anger, everything, like I realized, I got it. You know, my mom was in the ring with alcoholism, with my dad and my brother. And she had to, actually, she won too, but that's a whole, you know, I don't have enough time to tell you that story, how she got my dad sober. But, you know, I realized that she had a story. A story that she never told me. Is that it? Yeah. Is that it? He's done. I will tell you that after that moment, I had so much fun with my mother. Okay, she is a very funny lady. And everybody really, everybody liked my mother except for me. Okay? And she's got a really good sense of humor. And she's one of the few people still on this earth that could make me laugh so hard. And all that anger and all that blame and all that looking in the past is just part of my story now. I am not connected to it. I love and adore my mother. She gave me, now I'm able to tell you, she was fun to be around. I see the reason why everybody liked to hang out with her. My mother was like the mayor of San Pedro. Every time I took her somewhere, everybody knew her. Hey, Monica! You know, like Mom didn't not know. Everybody knows you. Yes, I know. I'm popular. It's like, she was, and, you know, I got to spend the last, 5 years of her life, I got to spend with her not being mad. And what a freaking party that was. It was so great. And when she left, you know, it was like, I'll see you soon. And we were good, you know, and I have nothing but love in my heart. Somebody in this room needed to hear this story. I mean, I don't know, like, really and truly, this was not what I was planning on talking about, but somebody here needs to hear it. It's like, she had a story, okay, and it was worse than mine. It was worse than mine. And those were the tools. She did the best she could. I hated when people said that from the beginning. It's like, no. She could have done better, you know? But she kept me from being in jail. She kept me from, because she scared me. She actually scared me right up until the day she took her last breath, which was a good thing, because I hate to think about what would have happened to me if I didn't know, like, you know, that she was watching me. And I love this. I love Al-Anon. I am so happy that I'm here talking with you guys. Happy birthday to me. And Keith is going to talk, and he'll be a lot better than me. So thank you.
Darlene, another round of applause. Oh my God, the image of her talking to her brother, like, saying, yeah, you know, one daughter is going to be on the pole, the other one's going to be turning tricks. It's like, I'm guessing they were like 10 and 8 years old or something. Like, it's so amazing. And really grateful to be here today, and really grateful to be sober for anybody who's new or relatively new. Welcome. And just really nice to come to such a fun event. I want to thank my daughter, Kira, for coming with me, my babe. She's a grateful member of Alma. I guess she's a member of Alma. I assume she's grateful, but she's amazing. And I'm not going to lie, coming to an event or a potluck or any event where the Alamans put it on is always really exciting for me because they do such an incredible job. Like the potluck, like AA potlucks are not the same as Alamon potlucks. But literally people coming in, you know, dessert time with the appetizers and just, you know, like it's just. So this was really a cool event. And yeah, I'm just really grateful to be here. And I'm sure like 5 years from now, someone's going to be standing at a podium in Gamblers Anonymous saying they got their start right here at this bingo day. You know, just like, I love gambling. I'm not going to lie. I love, love, love. And great job to our MC. Yeah, should we clap it up? Although I will say, after I kept losing, I started getting less receptive to all of her anecdotes. Anyways, much like Darlene, I grew up in an alcoholic home. I'm proud to say every member of my immediate family has been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous at one point or another. So I just so identified with the craziness of alcoholism. And if you grew up in that situation, you know what I'm talking about. You know, my parents were both also, you know, first generation. My mom was from Switzerland and my dad was from Ireland. My dad was this like, he had like a flash temper. He was like crazy. Like everybody in the neighborhood, I was scared to death of my dad. Everybody in the neighborhood was scared of my dad. He was just kind of a crazy person in his own way. And my mom was this Dr. Jekyll, Mrs. Hyde alcoholic, where by day she was just sweet, sweet woman. I mean, she's been here. She moved here from Switzerland in like the 50s, but she still has this really thick accent. And much like Darlene's mom, everybody knows her in the neighborhood. And she's just the sweetest woman. She used to go rescue stray cats and dogs and bring meals to the homeless. But then at night, she starts drinking and she just literally just transforms. Like, it was almost like she got like bigger. Like, I don't know, her hair would stand up. And she was like a mean drunk. Like, she gets a few drinks in her and she's like, some of my earliest memories growing up were like laying in bed and my mom picking like a fight with my dad, which is insane. Like the one person you wouldn't want to pick a fight with is him. And then I just remember thinking like, shut up, mom. And then she'd be like, help, he's coming after me, you know. And then it was just insanity, you know. But my parents did the best that they could. actually my brother, I went to go hear him speak. A couple months ago, he was speaking down in Laguna. He lives in Camarillo, and he called me up and goes, hey, it was Sunday night. He goes, hey, you do anything? And I happened to not be, and I was like, he's like, you want to come with me? I'm like, sure. So we went down, he told the story, and it just epitomizes the Prendergast household. Like, things always seem to go down on Sunday night. I don't know about anyone else, but like, that tension from the weekend in the alcoholic home, Sunday night, things are going down. And this one particular night, my brother, I'm the youngest of three. My middle brother, Kevin, definitely has whatever stereotypical middle child syndrome, he definitely has it. And he was always like, saw injustice and had to say something. And like, I was smart enough to just shut up. Like, I just know, like, and so this one night we're at dinner, we're at the dinner table, and he's like speaking to some injustice, some infraction my dad had committed, I guess. And my dad just put down his fork and just knocked my brother out of his chair, which is like, not, that's like typical, it's nothing. But the funny thing, I mean, not that that's funny, but my parents, a couple years before that, had decided to redo the carpet on the floor. And so they pulled up the carpet. I'm sure my dad got a quote, and the guy quoted him, like, he's like, well, I'll take it out. And so he ripped out the carpet with us or whatever, and then saw that there was hardwood floor under the carpet and just decided, like, we don't need carpet. We'll just leave it like this. But anyone who's like taking carpet out there, they know there's something called tack strip on the floor, which is basically nails sticking straight up. And that tack strip just laid down there for years in our house. So he knocks my brother out of the chair, but he's not done with him. So he gets him out and he drags him away from the dinner table right across the tack strip, just rips up his leg. And and just still going after him, which is like, again, not funny, but that's not what I'm saying is the funny part. Here's the funny part, in my opinion. Nobody at the dinner table even moved. Everyone just kept eating their food. Just like, just Kevin taking another beating, you know? It's like, it was just like typical. So it was just, it was crazy in my household. But I will say this, it was also, it was not all crazy bad. My parents in their way were both extremely loving. My dad, loving in his actions as far as like he got up early, he was in a union and drove a truck. He got done at 2 or 3 o'clock. He came home, he coached us in sports. He made dinner. He did all the, you know, kind of cooking and cleaning around the house. My mom worked downtown. She was incredibly loving with me especially. I was her favorite. And so I always, like growing up, it was definitely a combination of that kind of craziness, that alcoholism, and but a lot of good things. But for me, left to my own devices, as far back as I can remember, I always felt uncomfortable in my own skin. I always felt at dis-ease and discomfort. Like I just had that loud head as far back as I can remember. Just my head just, I know now, it's the bondage of self. I just didn't know that. I didn't have anything to identify it. I just was always just measuring myself against, you know, what did people think about me? What? And for me, how that manifests itself in my actions is like, I feel bad and I like take action. Like I have to take action. For me, I was a nuisance in classrooms. Every classroom I had growing up in like grade school, I had a segregated part of the classroom where everybody would be sitting here. The teacher would put me in the back. They build like a partition around me just because I can't, I cannot not disrupt everything. And I was always getting into fights. As a matter of fact, not that I hold on to anything, but the first day of fourth grade, don't worry, I'll get out of like elementary school by the time I'm done. But the first day of fourth grade, my teacher, her name was Mrs. Puffer. She actually was a bitch, if I'm being honest. But the first day of fourth grade, she pointed to a supply room closet. She's like, Prendergast, she's like, your chair is in there this year. And I had to sit in a supply room closet the entire fourth grade. And I actually had a pretty good year that year. A little more structure kind of helped me out. But anyways, so I felt, and my big outlet in my life was sports. Like as far back as I can remember, competitive sports, competition has just absolutely been like a driving force in my life. I just loved it. As a matter of fact, I heard a speaker kind of tell my story when I was relatively new, but he talked about like his like hope that he had. He always had like a lot of hope in his own way. He also was miserable and had difficulty, but for me, my outlet was competitive sports. I just loved, I would gather up the younger kids to play with my friends and the older kids and come on, let's go, we can do it. I would just have so much fun in that. And I really fell in love with golf when I was like 11 years old. My dad had tried to play professional golf. He was a really, really good golfer. And I kind of just found my calling or whatever you want to call it. I just knew this is what I wanted to do. And I was like so focused on, I want to go to UCLA. I want to get a scholarship to play golf at UCLA. And that was like my, I just so wanted it so bad. And I started working really, really, really hard. And actually, it's kind of funny. I had sworn off drinking and using drugs forever. I had actually a teacher who had really tried to kind of mentor me and help me out. Because I would talk about, I want to play at UCLA and this and that. And she pulled me aside and said, Keith, you know, there's a lot of really good athletes. They start high school, they start drinking and partying, and they don't even end up playing sports in college. And they get, you know, like it doesn't even last through high school. And I remember just going, wow. She goes, so don't start drinking and don't start doing drugs. And I was like, I'm never drinking, I'm never doing. And I happened to run into her in sobriety. I was teaching school in the same district that I actually grew up in Torrance Unified. And I had mentioned her name to somebody who was a friend of hers. She didn't say anything to me, and they surprised me. She came to visit me at my school. It was so really sweet. I go into the office, and there's Miss Hedstrom. I was like, oh, my God. I gave her a big hug. And she had, like, the yearbook or annual from when I was in middle school. And there's, like, a page that she had marked off. And it was a long handwritten note from me. And it was like, dear Mrs. Hedstrom, thanks for everything you've done for me. I know because of you, I'm never going to drink. I'm never going to do drugs. And she's like, so what's going on in your life? And I was like, well, I'm in AA now, so it didn't work out exactly the way I had planned. But I drank for the first time when I was 14 years old, and it just changed my life. It was like a revolution in my life. It was nothing changed, and everything changed because I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that you could feel that good that fast. It just absolutely, I'm going to steal a line from somebody, it fixed something in me that just needed to be fixed. And I didn't know it before then, but once I had it, and it happened for me after my first drunk. And what it is it just gave me that feeling like I just didn't care. Like all of that self, like all of that self-imprisonment, all of that just was just gone. And when something does that for me, it was like, there was no like, because I thought about it, I was a couple years sober and I was so serious about golf. I was so serious about trying to play at UCLA. And I wasn't going to drink, I wasn't going to do drugs, and then immediately after that, I just started drinking at every opportunity. I started getting loaded at every opportunity, and it never once crossed my mind, like, wait, I said I wasn't going to do this, and now I'm doing this all the time. And the reason it didn't cross my mind is because alcohol made me feel better than anything had in my life up to that point. It wasn't, there's not even a close second. I don't know about you, I love things that make me feel good right now. Like, I love, that's why I love stealing. It was mine. I love that feeling, you know. Like, if I would have won at bingo, yes. But no, not today. But I love things that make me feel good right now. And drinking absolutely did that. And within 6 months, I was drinking more days of the week that I wasn't. And within about a year, I don't know the exact time, but a year, year and a half, I was putting something in my system every single day. And I felt exactly like Bill Wilson talks about in Bill's story. Like money, he says money and applause came his way. For me, it wasn't money and applause, but I started high school. I did the best I'd ever done in school and high school for some reason. I can't explain it other than I just had that magic that alcohol was producing in my life. And I killed it in sports because I had worked super hard at golf, so I did really well. And it was like, man. Like, life is finally doable. My entire life before that, I struggled. I struggled with friendships. I was always in fights. I was always in trouble. I just had difficulty in life. And I felt like everybody was out to get theirs. And everybody's just out to screw each other over. And I had no loyalty to anybody. I had no feeling for anybody except my mom. But when I started drinking, that first year, couple years of my drinking, it was incredible. It was incredible. In some ways, that was like one of the best years of my life, I'll be honest. It was so life-changing. It was like, this is amazing. This is amazing. And my brother got sober, which I had, you know, some people are like, oh my God, why, you can't be an alcoholic. You drink. I didn't feel that way at all. I was like, good, go get some help. He needed some help. He had problems. He had like serious, serious problems. He was like doing hard drugs and dealing them and stuff like that. He like went off the deep end. He was dealing LSD. I didn't know anyone. You know, we lived in the nice area in the Hollywood Riviera. Like, I was like, someone's like, dude, your brother's selling acid. I was like, what? Like, and then he started having bad trips to LSD. And I'm not here to tell his story, but it is pertinent because it definitely affected mine. But he started having these bad trips to LSD. He'd be like, everybody get up. It was like 3 a.m. and everybody goes out to the living room like, what? He's just like, I have to die tonight for all of you to live. It was like, wait, what? Like, so you're like Jesus? Like, he's like, I was like, and my parents were like first generation European. They were like, what the? You're like, what is going on? And I was like, did he just say what I think he did? And it was no, if anyone's seen anyone on a bad trip, it is no joke. It is not a joke. I'm not making light of it because some people have them and they never come back. But he was like, losing his mind, and they rush him to the hospital, and he's like, and then he comes back and the next day, he's like, or a couple days later, he's like, well, I'm never doing that again, but I'm gonna keep dealing it. It's like, well, you know how that goes. A couple weeks later, everybody get up. He always made his transformation to the Messiah, and like in the middle of the night, it was never like noon, you know. And I was pissed because my parents had kind of been cool about us drinking. Like, I don't know, Europeans, at least back then, they just had a little different attitude. Like, we could have a beer sometimes with dinner. It was just kind of different. And now all of a sudden they're like, wait, something else is going on here. This is like wild. And I was getting mad, you know. As a matter of fact, my dad, there was one time, he was not the play it cool dad. I mean, that's the biggest understatement in the world. But this one time, my mom happened to be visiting family in Switzerland, And we were talking, like having a beer with some of my dad, and he goes, well, you know, I would try pot if you guys had some. And it was just like all three of us were like, well, Dad, I still remember this look on his face, like, whoa, like, you're in luck. We all happen to be holding, Dad. But it was just like, whoa. But anyway, so now my parents were like, what is going on? And then the third time he had one of these, like, episodes, he jumped in his car, and I remember my mom saying, he grabbed his car keys. And I was like, so what? I literally was like, I didn't care. It's affecting me. I could care less what happens to him. And he drove his car into this house going like 100 miles an hour. We lived up on this hill in Hollywood Riviera, and he went right and hit the corner of this house and knocked the entire house off its foundation. Like, had he been like this much further over, he would have gone right through this wall where this baby was sleeping. So we were incredibly lucky. But he ended up getting sober is the point. And that was like, it was incredible. He went through Delamo Hospital, and we would have these family therapy sessions, which I still to this day I say it because it just was so beautiful. I mean, it was just amazing. Like, I would give anything. They didn't record those sessions, but I would give anything for those, like, recording those sessions. Like, four of us practicing alcoholics and my brother who's out of his mind. And they're like, the first week, they're like on my dad about his drinking, and they're like, why don't you tell your dad how his drinking has affected you or something? My dad's like, yeah. Like, fire away. And I was like, I don't think that's a good idea, Dr. Lurie. He'll kill us all. Like, I'm just like, but the thing I remember about that is my mom just loving it, just like sticking it to him, like, it's his fault. Yeah, you know, and my dad just had that grinding look on his face. And then the next week, they were on my mom about her drink. And then she, like, stormed out of there. She's a real nosy son of a bitch. You know, just like, and then the next week, they were on my older brother Chris about his drinking, which I think is so funny. I think about it a lot. Like, he just spoke at a meeting that I went to, and it's so interesting to me about Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. Like, alcoholism and Al-Anonism are stone cold killers. Like, make no mistake about it. And that we have such different stories in our own way. We may have nothing in common. But my brothers, like, and I are so different. But we all have alcoholism. Our common bond, if you be alcoholic, is my relationship to alcohol and having alcoholism. And so that next week, my brother's kind of actually, I was sitting next to a gentleman who's like a surfer and contractor. Totally reminds me of my brother, kind of a tough guy, you know, like, So my brother's kind of a stubborn guy, and like a doctor was like, well, do you think you could stay sober 60 days? He's like, yeah. He's like, all right, we'll do it. He's like, fine. And he tried, and he realized he couldn't, and it started messing with him. And I think that is so funny. I don't know why, but I'm just not cut from that type of cloth. I couldn't be more different. Because the next week I show up, and like, I'm not an idiot. Like, I'm pretty sure I know what the topic's going to be this session. So I'm like, Dr. Lurie, before you get started, I just want you to know, since Kevin's been in here these last, whatever it was, days, I've decided to support him. So I haven't been drinking or using this time. And he just is eating it up. He's like, that's wonderful, Keith. I'm so glad to hear that. And my brother Chris is like, because we were in the parking lots in his VW van drinking Foster's tall cans right before that and smoking a joint. You know, I just felt like, I don't know, I just felt like I could really get more out of therapy, you know, just open up a little bit, you know. And I will say this, I'm not a personal believer of like God looking down and like, here, Keith, here's this parking space or anything. I just don't know that. I don't know. I really don't know. But I will say, if God doesn't look down, because I got arrested the next day. Like, God looking down, you son of a, you know, just like, but anyways. And that was during the time when my drinking was, you know, they talk about fun, and then fun with problems, and then all problems. Like, that was during the stage of my just so much fun. And drinking was just everything. It was just so, and much to my surprise, my alcoholism progress so rapidly. And within a couple years, I was drinking and using morning, noon, and night. And I'll tell you the craziest thing for me about my, for me with my alcoholism. And I don't know if you have, if you're new or anyone has identifies with this, but I lacked the perspective to see honestly what was really going on in my life, you know. Because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know if anyone else felt like this, I felt so alone. I felt so like nobody had been there for me. Nobody had really, I felt like this tragic figure, which is such a joke. It's so incredible, my level of inability to see the truth. I had so many people in my life trying to intervene in my life. I had coaches and teachers and counselors and juvenile probation officers and people just screaming at me. I remember the dean of my high school, because I was always getting into trouble. I was always getting searched. They always thought I was dealing drugs, which I never did successfully at all. But but they always were like searching me. Like they would be like, all right, pull him in, you know, and then this like this dramatic thing. It was just such a joke. But I remember her, you know, like it was just typical always whenever searching me, I'm like, go ahead, you know. And but that particular day, I had been on a run of drinking and partying for a few days and a couple nights, like no sleep, just that type of thing, which was not all the time, but it was like every day drinking and using. And then sometimes if I stole, like one time just ripped off of where I worked or a friend or something like that, be able to go on these crazy runs. And that particular day I'd been up for a couple days and I was sitting there all smug, like, go ahead, search me, you know. And she started crying. She said, look at you. Look at you. You were doing so well. Don't you see it? Don't you see what's going on? Because I had done really well. And they knew my brothers. They knew my family. Believe me, people knew my dad. Like, they would sometimes not. We'd get into trouble, and they would just be like, we don't want their dad coming down here. Because it would be like a scene. As a matter of fact, I was teaching school, like I said, in sobriety. And these kids didn't want to take this math test in an honors class, and so they called in a bomb threat to the school, which I totally understand. You know, like, and that makes sense. But this was right after the Columbine incident. And these kids got busted. Some of them, of course, they traced the car, whatever. Like five of these kids all got expelled from the district, honors middle school math class. The last kid was sitting for his parents to come pick him up, waiting in the office. And his dad came in and like somehow from the front door into the principal's office, seemed to make it in one bound and just knocked this kid out of his chair. And everyone was like, oh my God. And I got choked up. I had to call my dad. I was like, I love you, Dad. Like, that brought back some memories, let me tell you. But so it's like, you know, the dean of my high school, she had known my family and she had known I was doing really well. And I went from being all smug to like, oh my God, like, get me out of here. Like, get me out of here. And then when I talked to my parents, like, I want to go to college. I'm going to, you know, I was living in this world where I thought everything was fine. Everything was still fine. You know, it's like I'm drinking today, and drinking gives me that feeling of a job well done without doing a damn thing. And, you know, like what happened is my alcoholism progressed so far that I got kicked off the golf team my senior year for drinking. And I remember, I'll tell you something funny. When I was new in AA, people said, listen for the similarities. And I was incapable of listening for the similarities. People would be like, oh, I had blackouts, da, da, da. And I'd be like, I never had blackouts. I had blackouts from the very beginning. I just loved it. I knew that meant I had a good time. Like, they didn't scare me. I loved it. I loved drinking for oblivion. And people said, like, someone get up to the podium and say, I wasn't going to drink today, and I'd be drunk by noon. And I'd think, you need AA. It sounds like you're weak. You don't have willpower. That's what my head would be thinking. You know, but I'll tell you something. My junior year in high school, when my alcoholism really started taking over, our golf coach got sick, or he actually got gangrene or something, they amputate part of his leg or something. And I was like, good, I didn't like him anyways. But so that football coach took over. And he was like, I don't know anything about golf. I was the best player. He goes, just run the team. So I love coaching. I coach my daughter Kieran basketball. I still to this day coach a ton of basketball. I coach high school club. I just love it. But back then, it was like, he put me in charge, and I was like, yes, let's go. I loved it. I arranged it. We started having this incredible year. Like, we beat a couple teams we'd never beat before, and we had a chance to, like, win our league, which we were always in third place behind, like, Palos Verdes and Rolling Hills. And we, on the biggest match of the year, I showed up drunk. And I'm telling you, there is no way I would have let that happen. It was so important to me. It meant everything to me. That was the first time I ever kind of thought, like, what just happened? Because when I got up that day, I was so excited. You know, I had set the ladder, you know, like, arranged the groups, what we're going to do. And then it was, like, so excited at lunch and went out with my buddies. And I was like, yeah, I'm not going to, you know. And then this one guy said, I didn't even know him. We went to this guy's house. I didn't know him. And he goes, you can have one beer, right? And I was like, yeah, of course I could have one beer. And I showed up drunk, and the look on my teammate's face is like, are you drunk? Like, what the hell? And I was the best player, so I teed off first, blew two balls out of bounds, and we got murdered and destroyed. And it was like the next day, I just had to pretend like it just didn't happen. But I got kicked off the team my senior year, and I was like, what am I going to do? Like, and there's a line in Bill's story where it says, alcohol ceased to be a luxury, became a necessity. And I'm not here to say I packed 30 years of hard drinking into 5 years of drinking and using, because I just don't think it's possible. But for me, I couldn't stand the conditions of my life anymore. And just being a little drunk and loaded wasn't enough. It had to be oblivion all the time. And I started doing crazier and crazier things to stay drunk and loaded all the time. Started breaking into cars in the neighborhood, breaking into houses of people I knew. And I will say, I don't want to paint the wrong picture up here. I would, because I can't stand it when people try and badden up their stories from the podium. The truth of the matter, I was just some two-bit punk weasel, just cheat, chisel, mooch. I was just I'm not trying to brag to impress the ladies up here. But that is a fact. That is a fact. I wasn't some hardcore criminal. I was a worm. And nobody meant anything to me. When my brother got into that car accident, he got in an altercation with the police. And they almost beat him to death. And he deserved a good beating, because he put two of them in the hospital. He bit one of the pieces of the guy's arm off. He was on a bad trip. You know, he went crazy, and they beat him almost to death. He was strapped down in USC hospital, and my family was going to see him. And they said, are you coming? And I was like, nope. And I honestly didn't care if he lived or died. I'm not a person who feels bad about things, but when I made that amends to him, I could not. I couldn't keep it together, because I knew the person I was, you know. Anyways, I turned 18. I got arrested a couple more times, and the last time I got arrested, to tell you what a fine, upstanding citizen I was, it was for strong arming someone for a purse in broad daylight. And I'd love to say that's not the type of person I was, but that's exactly the type of person I was. And I was sitting in that jail cell, and something happened to me that was the most important thing that's ever happened in my life. And it was not like, oh my God, I gotta stop drinking. Because I just didn't even think about that. But I had this feeling like, this is what my life is gonna be like. This is what my life is gonna be like. I'm gonna keep doing these things and hurting people. And that image when I was in the back of the police car in handcuffs, and that woman half an hour later still hyperventilating. I mean, to tell you what an idiot I was, it was 3:30 in the afternoon at Pacific Coast Highway. Like, literally, almost every resident of Redondo Beach witnessed me trying to steal this woman's purse. Like, I'm just an idiot. I don't know what to tell you, but anyways. But I was in that jail cell, and I knew that this is what my life was going to be like. And for me, the most important thing was I knew there was nothing I could do about it. It was going to be like this the rest of my life. And it's funny, we were talking, sitting there. I'm sorry, what's your name?
Jamie.
Jamie. We were both sharing experiences of when we hit that moment, something happened where I didn't end up having to go to jail. And Jamie had a very similar. It's funny, we were in the midst of bingo, we just started talking, and we're like, within 5 minutes, both of us were like choked up and like almost started crying. It's like, And nothing, like Norm Alpin used to say, nothing, nobody cries like those AA guys, that's for sure. But, or, and he used to say, we laugh because we're miserable, we cry because we're happy, you know. And it's like, I'm so grateful. What happened is I got out of that jail cell and I went to see this lawyer. I didn't call my brother who was stark raving sober at the time. I went to see this lawyer because I mean, I don't know what I was going to see a lawyer for. When the Good Samaritans of Redondo Beach make a citizen's arrest on you, there's really nothing to talk about. But I went to see this lawyer, and I played golf with his son, and he invited me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, you want to meet me at a meeting tomorrow night? And I skateboarded to that meeting on a skateboard I bought with a stolen credit card. And I was wearing a pair of high-top sneakers I bought with a different stolen credit card. And I was just lost and broken. As much as any human being could be at 18 and a half years old. And I skateboarded, I walked into that meeting, and I didn't feel at home. It was a meeting a lot like this, with like wood floors, and people were stomping, it was the foot stompers, and they stomped their feet. There was all this energy, it was just way too much. Like, it was way too much. It felt like everybody's like, hi! You know, because you're like, I get it, you're 18, like they come, oh my God, you know. And it was just like, whoa, like, just tone down that welcome a little bit, please. You know, I was like, and I just didn't understand it. I honestly didn't understand what was going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really genuinely didn't. Like, what were people so interested in? What were so like, why are you so happy to see me? Or why, what's really the deal here? And I'll tell you something that I did come to find out to be an attraction. You know, it was like people weren't necessarily interested in me per se or whatever. It was like all they wanted to find out is like, hey, are you having a problem drinking? Like, can you not stop drinking? Or do you want to do something about your drinking? Is your life not working anymore? And do you want to do something about it? And if that's the case, then we're really interested in you. We will do anything for you if you're new. That's been my experience, you know. And I look back on those times, you know, I'm extremely grateful for a lot of things in my life, but at that time, I just feel like I was given this grace. I don't even know what the heck was happening. You know, the next day, my phone rang. I didn't make a decision to call it, to join AA. I just went to that meeting. It was just information. And this guy came and got me and took me to a men's day. That lawyer had given this guy my number, and this guy was on fire for AA. He was like 48 days sober or something, and absolutely on fire for AA. And on the way home, he had this long hair, he's a musician, all gray, but he was just so like this, like, and he's like, oh man, the meeting, I got this home group, it's just the best meeting in the world, it's unbelievable, it's this morning meeting, and I don't know if anyone's had this experience, but something came out of my mouth, and I had no plans of saying it, and I asked that guy if he would give me a ride to that meeting the next day, and I'm telling you, it was one of those, like, right when it came out of my mouth, I regretted saying it. Like, why did I just say that? And then he was like, of course. He was all fired up. And there was him and a couple other guys, all who had between like 40 and 90 days sober. They lived in San Pedro. And they would drive and come pick me up in Holly Riviera, which is about 25 minutes away from San Pedro, and to this meeting in La Mita, which is 5 minutes away from San Pedro. It was a morning meeting, 7 a.m., and these three guys got my sorry ass there every single day, Monday through Friday. They never once called me and said, dude, I just feel like making the five-minute drive this morning. They got me there every single day, and that became my first home group, the Sunrise Group at meeting Attitude Adjustment in Harbor City. And, you know, it's funny. I was about 40-some days sober, and those three guys, actually one of them helped me get into a recovery house in San Pedro, actually. And I think they just wanted to shorten their commute, but no, I'm just kidding. And that really kind of changed my life. You know, I was just this lost kid. I was a filthy, disgusting human being, which has nothing to do with alcoholism. This is Dirty People Anonymous, but I just was like, I just didn't know how to function. And like in that house, in that recovery house, that structure was huge for me. It was just a big deal. They made me take action that I wouldn't have taken otherwise. They were like, all right, new business. Keith, you know, and then the chairman would leave the meeting and be like, Keith, yo, clean up your room, dude. Do your laundry. It stinks, like that. And they would just move on. And I would be like, wait, hold on. Can I explain? You know, like, I don't know about it, anyone else, if there's any other explainers here tonight. But I got some bad news for you. if you are an explainer like me. Nobody cares why you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. And I mean nobody, you know. And they just got me to take action. They made me get a job. They made me get a sponsor. Or it was like, yo, you don't have, because I'd be like, I don't know about you, but this whole idea of like sponsorship, I just didn't feel like it was for me. So I remember hearing some guy say, you know, I want to date this girl, but my sponsor says I shouldn't, so I'm not going to. And I was like, yeah, I don't think sponsorship's for me. That doesn't sound like it. And I just didn't make sense to me. Like, I live my life 23 hours and 57 minutes a day. I'm going to talk to this complete stranger for 3 minutes. They're going to tell me to do something. I'm going to do it. Like, it just doesn't make sense. To this day, it doesn't make sense. Like, I remember talking to some guy. This was a couple years ago, and I was kind of hitting him. You know, the usual, you have a sponsor, and he had had enough. Like, I was the 100th person who's given a hard time about sponsoring. He goes, let me just tell you something. I was like, okay. You know, like, I am fundamentally against the idea of sponsorship. And I was like, me too, brother. Me too, you know. But it works, you know. And these guys made me get a sponsor, and I asked this guy to be my sponsor. He was hanging around the recovery house, and he'd buy pizza sometimes. I was too, like, he was actually dating one of the guys in the house, and I guess I was the only one who didn't realize it, you know. And this is 1989 in San Pedro, and I guarantee there was not a lot of guys out in San Pedro in 1989. And but that guy saved my life, and I will forever be grateful to him. I have a ton of fond memories. My fondest memories in my life are going over to that guy's house and going through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous together and finding out what alcoholism is and finding out, much to my surprise, that I'm an alcoholic and that my solution is Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, things just happened very, very, very slowly for me, for sure. I was 18. I'm like, now I'm sober, I'm going to build my empire. You know, it turns out not so much for me. Like, my first, like, 4 years of sobriety, I worked at a gas station in San Pedro, South Shores Unocal. And San Pedro really is like a small town. And it was an awesome place for me to work and kind of lay my foundation in sobriety. And, you know, I slowly went back to school. I ended up transferring to UCLA, which was still my dream school. And like the day I graduated from UCLA was like one of the coolest days of my life. You know, I had about 6 or 7 years sober at that time. I had moved to West LA and joined the Pacific Group. And my dad and I had a very strained relationship for years. But really it was like that day, there was like this healing. You know, I got lost from the people I was with, and he got lost from the family because this big crowd kind of rushing out. We ran into each other, and we both just cried. We just cried in each other's arms. He's like, I'm so proud of you. You did this all on your own, you know. And because my dad had never, like, I was suddenly opposite of him. He was kind of in your face, honest, and I was just this weasel, you know. And, but he was really, really proud. And I was like, it actually wasn't me, Dad. It was Alcoholics Anonymous, to be honest, you know. And shockingly, I was one of those alcoholic men who had problems with relationships. Like, I know I'm like probably the only one in this room, but it would be like I'd be running out of one house that was on fire after another. And then I realized I was the one setting the fires, you know, like, I was like, oh my gosh, it's me, you know, but, and then eventually I found, you know, I met, Yuko, some of you may know, and we got married and had kids. I will say, I think there's some misrepresentation in Alcoholics Anonymous about children. I'll be very honest. Like, everyone's like, oh, I want to thank my daughter, so-and-so, my son. It's just so, I remember thinking, yeah, that sounds kind of cool to have kids. Let me tell you something. Kids are a giant pain in the ass. Oh my God. They are so much work. They're so selfish. Like, and they're so easy to make, and they're so hard to take care of. Yeah. But the funniest is, like, my oldest daughter, Kiko, she was a dream. She was this sweet, considerate pleaser. She was so much fun. I used to joke, she was like my jealous girlfriend. She'd be like, where are you going, Daddy? When are you coming home? You know, like, she was so sweet. And then my daughter, Kira, was a nightmare. She was a liar, a manipulator. I don't know where she got it from. I swear to God, like, it must be her mom. But anyways, and she was, like, we were genuinely concerned about Kira. Wow. I used to hate it when people said, I'm saving a seat for my kid. I would be like, not me. not me. I did not want, and I lived under the misconception that I could love any potential alcoholism out of my kids. I was like, no way. Not me. Not us. I really felt that way. And I, a lot of things, but I was a present father, and I loved being a father to those girls. It was so much fun. I mean, Kira is my best friend. And we are super close. Like, the meeting on the way out, we were just hanging out and talking. It's just like so much fun. She's such a good person. But back then, she wasn't. I'm going to be honest with that. But Kiko was this dream kid. And when she started drinking and her alcoholism took off, I couldn't believe it. There's no way, no chance, my daughter. I lived under this conception that I could somehow control her alcoholism. It's insane. But when her alcoholism just went through our house, like Grant went through Richmond, it just was insane. It just destroyed our house. Yuko and I had the hardest couple of years of our marriage. I actually talked about getting a divorce. And it just had such an impact on Kira. You know, it was just crazy. And Kiko ended up getting, you know, going. We had to kick her out of the house at 19. And she ended up 6 months later living in her car. And it was just so heartbreaking. She sometimes would pull up out in front of our house and just sleep in her car. And she had too much pride to knock on the door and wake it up. And it would just be so heartbreaking. It was the hardest thing, and not even close second in my life, you know. But then she met up with some career criminal, and he stole her car and beat her up. And she ended up getting sober. And it was just like I had known and been around enough. I will say this, I would talk to people about Kiko. Nothing made me feel better than one person that I could talk to, and I felt some relief, was Vinoy. And I would call her and check in, and she gave me some direction, fortunate. I've been around alcoholism and the family disease and family recovery. I knew I couldn't help her. We stayed out of it and let her go down, but she ended up getting sober. She was in this treatment center, and she was like, well, I'm not going to Pacific Group. And my wife was like, well, nobody invited you. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, we literally was like, I figured she would join Young People AA. I didn't care. I just stay out of it. I knew I couldn't do anything about it. And we did stay out of it. And she called us one day, and she goes, I got a sponsor today. This woman came in on a panel. And I was like, oh, that's awesome. Good job. And I was like, oh, what's her name? She's like, Georgia. I was like, Georgia B? And she's like, yeah. And I was like, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh. And I thought, she might be coming to the Pacific Group. And sure enough, she started like that. And then pretty soon, like fast forward like 3 weeks, she's like, are you coming to Thursday night? She's like, giving me shit about my meetings. It's like, all right. But anyways, it's about time for me to shut up. I'll say this, and then I'll sit down. I'm like, I'm so grateful. If anyone is new or relatively new, I'm so thankful. Like, I've been sober for 35 and a half years, you know, and I'm so thankful that I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 2 years sober when I was convinced in my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And I'm so grateful I had enough grace or whatever, and I got to meetings and I had good people in my life, and I even had worked the steps already on that. But it was really 2 years sober when I really understood, like, wow, like, alcoholism is my problem and Alcoholics Anonymous is my solution. And I had this sense, like, as long as I am around AA and active in AA, then things are going to be all right, you know. And I thought of, like, when I was relatively new, I went to the South Bay Roundup. And this guy got up, his name was, and they say, Fred's gonna read chapter 5. And I was just sitting there, kind of like, oh, whatever. And everyone's like, and he's like, my name's Fred, I'm a grateful alcoholic. And the crowd just went into a frenzy, and I just remember going, man, I hope Fred gets into a car accident. It's like, I mean, okay, we gotta be here, but nobody could be that grateful. Like, stop. Like, it was just seething, you know. And so, in Fred's honor, I'm gonna talk about gratitude. Like, what am I the most grateful for, I thought about? And I'm grateful for a lot of things. You know, having the relationship I do with my kids and our, you know, all of us in recovery and in sobriety, I'm just so, so grateful. Life has had its ups and downs, believe me. Life has had its ups and downs. And, my dad was 5 years sober and drank again and drank himself to death. And we've had, you know, challenges or whatever. But these are the three things I'm the most grateful for. And the first thing I'm the most grateful for is my physical sobriety. Like, I'm grateful that I'm not living under the lash of alcoholism today. You know, like I said, I see it all the time. If you go to enough meetings, you see it. Alcoholism is a killer. And it's just as deadly today for me as it was in 1989, in June of 1989. I'm so grateful that I didn't put anything in my system that affects me from the neck up today, just today. Like, that's an unnatural state for me. And I don't ever want to lose sight of how lucky I am to be in that state. It's that state of grace, you know. And I take action to ensure it. I don't just live on it. I have to continually go to be involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and continually try and help people, you know. And the second thing I'm most grateful for is how I feel in my own skin. You know, I feel comfortable in my own skin. I never felt comfortable in my own skin growing up. Whether it's growing up in that environment or just my personality or whatever it is, and well into sobriety, I didn't feel comfortable in my own. Sometimes, you know, we talk to somebody who's got a couple years, like, what am I doing wrong? I'm struggling. It's like, you're not doing anything wrong. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. That's been my experience. And I'm grateful for how I feel it. You know, there's ups and downs. Like, lately, kind of in between. I got let go of my job in February. I've been unemployed, and my wife had to go get a job, which is, as they say, like a functioning alcoholic is an alcoholic whose spouse works. I've kind of gotten used to that. Like, but you know, like, so I'm getting ready to get this job. I'm going to go back into teaching after 20 years in the mortgage business. And you know, sometimes it's been like struggle, like that, having that lack of structure or whatever. But I feel comfortable in my own skin most of the time. And I know that's a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, these steps and having a God. And I'm extremely grateful for that. And the last thing I'm the most grateful for is this purpose we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I truly feel like it's the best deal in town. You know, like, Alcoholics Anonymous works because it's so against my nature. I truly believe that. But I have connections with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's people I don't even know their last name, and I feel like a genuine love for when I see them. Like, a genuine caring and love for. And for me, for somebody who's so naturally isolated and alone and by myself, that's like a spiritual experience for me. I truly believe that, and I'm so grateful. I'm sure if you're new, you hope my car veers off the 5 on the way home and I smash it up a little bit. But if you're new and in this fellowship, in either fellowship, and your life's not working, or you can't stop drinking, or you can't stop trying to, whatever it is, I wish those three things on you. So thanks for letting me share.
Let's thank